Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is Freight in the Environment, Part 1. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you do need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing your audio over the computer as well. Today we'll have four presenters: Dr. James Weinbrake of the Rochester Institute of Technology, Rebecca Watts Hull and Alan Jones of the Southeast Diesel Collaborative, and Alan Bates of Shore Power Technologies. Professor James J. Weinbrake, PhD, is currently Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Co-Director of the Laboratory for Environmental Computing and Decision Making at the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. Most recently, Dr. Weinbrake has published on issues related to the environmental impacts of goods movement, including health risk assessments of ocean-going vessels, total fuel cycle analyses of alternative fuels, and cost effectiveness of emissions reduction technologies and policy for trains, trucks, and ships. Dr. Weinbrake recently served on the National Academies of Science Committee on a study of potential energy savings and greenhouse gas reductions from transportation, and on the NAS Academy on an assessment of fuel economy technologies for medium and heavy duty vehicles. Rebecca Watts Hull is director of Mothers and Others for Clean Air, a nonprofit education and advocacy project of the American Lung Association in Georgia. This air quality program engages parents, healthcare professionals, scientists, and other concerned citizens in clean air initiatives, including diesel retrofit projects. For the past 2 years, she has led the Freight Planning Committee of the Southeast Diesel Collaborative in an effort to better integrate emissions reductions into freight planning as the Southeast prepares for the expected post-Panamax growth in goods movement. Alan Jones is manager of the Policy Office in the Long Range Planning Division of the Tennessee Department of Transportation. He joined TDOT in 2004, and he advises TDOT officials on transportation policy issues, including air quality, energy, freight, land use, sustainable transportation, and livable communities. He directs the state's Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement, or CMAQ, program, conducts research on transportation policy innovations, and develops strategic recommendations for making the state's transportation system more sustainable. Alan Bates is Vice President of Marketing for Shore Power Technologies. He has been a key team member in several early stage ventures and has consulted for a number of Fortune 500 companies, including Apple, Cisco, Disney, HP, Google, and Microsoft. He drives to work every day in an all-electric Nissan Leaf. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, please type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during the presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we will attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. The PowerPoint presentations used today are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. They'll also be online in the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript, and I'll notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, have your name typed into the chat box. In a moment, I'll upload more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar, and I'll also put an evaluation form in there, and I encourage everybody online to download the evaluation form and submit it. I should mention that the seminar is not yet available on the AICP website, but it should be in the next few days, and I'll send out an email once it's available. So we'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you that just joined us, is Freight in the Environment, Part 1. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box, and they'll be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. Our first presenter will be Dr. James Weinbrake of the Rochester Institute of Technology. Jamie, if you give me a second, I will get your presentation up, and you can go ahead and get started.
Thanks, Jennifer. Hi, everybody. Jennifer, I appreciate that introduction. So given the limited amount of time we have, I'm going to talk about achieving emissions reductions in the freight sector. I'll go through some of the overview material rather quickly so we can get to the heart of the issue, and that is how do we achieve emissions reductions in the freight sector. I do want to acknowledge some folks. Some of this work was funded in part by a grant from the Transportation and Climate Initiative, TCI, and that's administered by the Georgetown Climate Center. And I put the web address for TCI on this slide, and so if you download these slides, you'll have that address. And I also am grateful to Jim Corbett at the University of Delaware, Scott Hawker, who's a colleague at RIT, and Carl Korfmacher, also at RIT, for some of the work related to the gift model, and I'll talk about what the gift model is in a few minutes. So in the 15 or 20 minutes that I have to discuss this issue, I'm kind of laying it out as we would in thinking about solving these kinds of problems, where we want to understand the problem, characterize the data, identify the reduction opportunities, and then implement the results. And then we'll have some time for question and discussion afterwards. So understanding the problem, and by the way, each one of my section headers has kind of a punchline under it. So this short section is going to talk about freight being closely tied to economic growth. Freight is growing, and the bulk of freight in the United States is moved by high energy intensive and greenhouse gas intensive modes, such as trucks. So let's look at each one of these issues here. This graph, and I hope the slides that I'm seeing are also keeping up with everyone else's computers, this shows on the y-axis ton miles of goods moved in the U.S. between 1980 and 2007. And on the x-axis shows GDP. And the real point of this graph is just to show this close relationship between goods movement and GDP. And the text box in the middle says, for every $1 trillion increase in GDP, we expect an additional 140 billion ton miles of goods movement. So as we all know, economic growth and goods movement is very closely tied, as this graph illustrates.
The straight line, I assume, is a G.
Secondly, if we look at these freight movements by mode, we get a chart like this since 1980 to 2007. The colors here, the bottom color is truck, the red is rail, the green is domestic shipping, the aqua blue is pipeline, and then there's a little slice that you can barely see up top, and that's air movement. And the y-axis, again, is in ton miles over time. So you can kind of see the breakdown. Mostly we're dominated by truck and rail with other contributions from some other modes. By the way, these trends are expected to continue. You can see they've been going up at a steady pace, and the Department of Energy predicts that they'll continue to increase over the next 30 years.
Downturn.
So when we have that kind of freight growth, and with those kinds of modes, if we're interested in energy consumption and petroleum dependence and greenhouse gas emissions, we need to look at something called energy intensity. So on the y-axis here is energy intensity, and that's measured in British thermal units, or BTUs, per ton mile. British thermal unit is a unit of energy. And on the x-axis, we have historically where we've been. And the top line here, the blue, is our truck energy intensity. And the two bottom lines, the red and the green, one is rail and one's domestic shipping. And the point of this is to illustrate the very high energy intensity of truck movements for goods movement in the United States. Almost 5 to 10 times larger in terms of moving a ton mile of goods with trucks versus rail or domestic shipping. Now, when you put all that together, and I should note here that that these are top-down averages, and I'm going to get to some of the caveats when we look at modal comparisons, some of the dangers in using these top-down averages, these top-down U.S. averages, and I'll get to that a little bit later in the presentation. Here's a graph that isn't in energy units, but it's in carbon dioxide units. And the x-axis, you can see the units, grams of CO2 per ton kilometer. This was some work that we did for the International Maritime Organization, IMO, a couple of years ago when they were doing a greenhouse gas inventory of ships. And the reason I like this graph is instead of having a point estimate of what the greenhouse gas intensity is for each of these modes, and you'll see on the y-axis, there's a number of different types of ships. And then the bottom two items on the y-axis is rail and highway, or road. But instead of having point estimates, these have estimates that are in a range, and they vary based on the way you're operating your vehicle or your vessel or your locomotive, the type of goods you're carrying, the speed at which you're moving those goods. And the interesting thing here is you see things like road and rail can overlap. And so, again, this is this is kind of a warning, and when we try to use a point estimate for a top-down estimate, we can sometimes run into trouble because there are cases where rail, for example, can have higher emissions than trucks, depending on how fast that rail is moving and what the locomotive is pulling. Well, if you put all this together, for the United States, you get a somewhat busy pie chart here. But quickly, what I've highlighted here in the yellow boxes are some of the goods movement modes that we really care about, as well as light-duty vehicles. This pie chart shows the total emissions from the transportation sector in the U.S., about 2 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalents per year. And that's about a third or so of the total U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases. And you'll see the vast majority, or 57%, of those emissions come from light-duty vehicles. It's over on the right side of this pie chart, the big blue slice there. But freight trucks are responsible for about 18%, and commercial light trucks about 2%. And then you have rail and domestic shipping that are much smaller contributions. But, this kind of points out that trucking is an area that has long been neglected until only recently in terms of looking for ways to make them more efficient and reduce emissions. And we're starting to see that in the federal sector and in some of the states as well. So that kind of paints the picture from a energy and greenhouse gas standpoint. And I think the picture it paints is one where we're increasing freight, we're increasing goods movement, it's tied to economic growth, very dependent on petroleum, and therefore there's high levels of greenhouse gas emissions. And now we have to start thinking about what do we do about that problem. So some recent work that we did was to help characterize the data, and TCI, the Transportation Climate Initiative, run out of Georgetown Climate Center, helped fund this, where we really concentrated on the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic region, which is the TCI region. And we dug down deep into CFS commodity flow survey data to really explore and provide data sets and maps for the TCI region on their freight flows. One of the things that come out of the charts I'm about to show now are that truck really dominates in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic for about 87% of goods movement, and that's about 50% of the commodities moved in the region are, you can see them on the slide here, gravel and stone, refined fuel and non-metallic minerals and coal. So I think I'm gonna skip this slide because it really talks about the characterization, and my point in this part of the presentation is to kind of offer that we need to really understand the flows and the origins and destinations and the types of routes that goods are being moved on within a region or within a state if we really want to do anything about getting emissions reductions. So the scope of this study, you can see on the map here, it's the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states. And we looked at all three modes, truck, rail, and ship, and we looked at all the commodities that were reported. And what we could do with that data, and it's a huge data set, and there's dozens of slides and graphs that we could show, but I just wanted to illustrate with a couple here. This is the graph that shows the freight flows by state,
Pennsylvania,
in this region, and you can see on the y-axis the different states. And we have it broken up by mode. So Pennsylvania in this TCI region is responsible for the largest amount of goods movement. And you can see the bulk of that is made up of trucks. The blue in this bar chart, it represents trucks. So the thing that should stand out in this type of picture is the amount of goods moved in the TCI states, the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states, that is really driven by trucks. Another thing we can do, which is really important, is to understand where the flows are going geographically. So here's a chart that's showing some of the inter-region flows, that is, the freight flows going from one location within this region to another location within this region. And the color red here means there's a large amount of flow coming into that county. This is shown by county. The green is a much lower amount. And you can see that these are pretty much around our population centers. We did these kinds of maps for a number of different ways to slice the data. Here's an example of flows coming from outside the region into the region and what those flows look like. And you'll see in a minute why this is important. We really need to understand those origin and destination pairs in order to do the analyses to calculate emissions and energy consumption within a particular region or state. So identifying energy and emissions reduction opportunities, you know, we understand the problem now. We've kind of drilled down into the data. There's still some more that we have to do in terms of data analysis, but we want to start thinking about reduction opportunities. And I'm going to present something that we dubbed the IFTOL framework and how that could provide insights into some emissions reduction options. And I'll also spend a couple minutes talking about the GIFT model that we can use to evaluate these options. So the IFTOL framework, this was presented at Asilomar a couple years ago, but where we kind of categorize some of the actions that we can take to look at intermodalism or infrastructure, fuels, technology, operations, logistics, and demand, stuff we actually consume. And it's just a useful framework, we think, to help us characterize different options and policy and program alternatives. In exploring the effects of some of those possible alternatives, we've implemented the GIFT model. The GIFT model is the Geospatial Intermodal Freight Transportation Model. It's been jointly developed at RIT and the University of Delaware, and I should also recognize the Department of Transportation Maritime Administration and the Great Lakes Maritime Research Institute for some of the funding to help us develop the GIFT model. The GIFT model, it's a pretty interesting model. What we've done here, and the purpose of the GIFT model is to help us explore intermodal transportation of goods, or single mode, but give us the option to explore multi-mode transportation of goods, and look at the environmental and energy and other types of criteria that we may want to look at in terms of optimal ways of moving goods within a region. And how we've done this is we've taken the road network of the U.S. and Canada and the rail network and the waterway network, which we have for the entire globe, and we've connected them in ArcGIS software through, if you look at the bottom right part of this figure, through intermodal transfer facilities, what we call transportation hubs. And that could be a transportation hub, could be a port, could be a rail yard. It could be a truck-to-truck transfer point. And so once we have these networks connected to this hub, we could start to model flows that might start on a highway, move over to rail, go onto a ship, and then maybe go back to a highway. The other thing that we've done that's kind of interesting with this GIFT model is we're able to populate the network with not only the shortest distance types of data, as you might find if you go to Google Maps or MapQuest and you put in a starting point and an end point, Google Maps will show you the shortest distance or the shortest time to get from point A to point B. And we can do that, but we've also put attributes in the network related to environmental impacts and cost impacts. So for example, this allows us to run cases where we have an origin and a destination and we want to run the least carbon, the least CO2 route, or the least cost route, or the least particulate matter route, or the least NOx route. And so we have that ability to put those attributes in the network and then optimize the solution based on our choice of objectives. And so this shows a case that we looked at from moving goods from Montreal to Cleveland. The difference between the left case and the right case is we looked at two different kinds of ships. One ship on the left side was a smaller ship. The one on the right is a bigger ship. But the point is that we can now map alternative routes based on our objectives, whether it's least time, least cost, or least CO2. Why that's useful is it lets us do some trade-off analysis. So here's an example of that trade-off analysis, looking at just two parameters, carbon dioxide on the top and time of delivery on the bottom. And you can see in the top graph, truck has the largest amount of CO2 emissions for this particular trip compared to ship and rail. But it's also the quickest if you look at the bottom graph, which shows time of delivery. So it gives policymakers an opportunity to look at these different trade-offs and make determinations about what might be best in a particular situation. How do we incentivize, for example, goods to go on one mode versus another, and what are the trade-offs if we choose to do that?
Policymakers don't make that decision.
Here's another example of it shows a little bit better of short sea shipping along the eastern seaboard from Jacksonville up to Raleigh. And in this case, we've identified, I only have the bar chart of the CO2 comparison because I wanted to show some intermodal examples. If you look at this bar chart, there's a truck-only route, there's a rail-only route, but then there's a ship-truck. The third bar in is a ship-truck combination, and the fourth bar is a rail-truck combination. And I think this is important when we're thinking about reductions. It's this intermodal component that allows us to meet the goods movement needs of the industry and of our consumers, but also get some of the reductions that we would like to see for the environment. And lastly, as I come up on the last few minutes I have here, implementing results would be next. So once we have this analysis done and we really understand the data and the freight flows within a region and we really understand the environmental impacts and the energy consumption characteristics of those freight flows, we have to think about, well, what do we do? And so we've taken the IFTOLD model and aligned it with just some example policy options. So the policy options that we have here are on the left-hand side, and that's efficiency standards and taxes and subsidies, and you can read them down the rows here. And we identify where in the IFTOLD framework those types of policy options fit in. I think if nothing else, this just gives us a framework to brainstorm and to think about how different options like infrastructure investment or like alternative fuel regulations or weight restrictions, where they might affect different points in the entire freight system. And you may disagree, or we can argue about where these dots are in this table, and that's not so much the point. The real point is just creating a framework where we can look at policy options and see how they might address mm-hmm. different elements in the freight system. And I think that's my 20 minutes or so. So I see there's questions, and Jennifer, you have to, are we going to wait until the end to answer some of these questions?
Yes, we'll go through all the presentations first, and then we'll get to questions at the end.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Jamie. Our next presentation is going to be given jointly by Rebecca Watts-Hull and Alan Jones, representing the Southeast Diesel Collaborative. And if you give me a second, I'll move your presentation back to the beginning. I'm not sure. There you go. So, Rebecca and Alan, you guys can go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jennifer. My name is Alan Jones, and I'm with the Tennessee Department of Transportation. And Rebecca and I are both participants in the Southeast Diesel Collaborative. I want to start by talking about that just a moment. We're also going to talk a little bit about diesel emissions and non-attainment, the contribution that diesel emissions are making to non-attainment status for particularly areas in the Southeast. The connection between diesel emissions and public health. Talk some about freight movement hotspots where there's an unusually high concentration of diesel emissions. And then finally, and hopefully we can move through those first four topics fairly quickly and focus on the solutions and how we might reduce emissions from freight. The Southeast Diesel Collaborative is, as the slide says, a voluntary public-private partnership of people, organizations that are interested in working together to reduce diesel emissions. That's basically the mission of the Southeast Diesel Collaborative. What can we do together on a voluntary basis to reduce diesel emissions to improve public health? It is part of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's National Clean Diesel Campaign, and there are diesel collaboratives in other parts of the country. Our particular group, the group that Rebecca and I, that Rebecca leads and that we've been working on together, was formed to identify and pursue strategies for trying to integrate consideration of air quality and public exposure to diesel emissions and how we might reduce those exposures, integrating that into freight planning. And the Southeast is particularly concerned about freight and the growth in freight volume due to the projected freight growth that the Southeast will experience as a result of the Panama Canal expansion. Non-attainment issues. We already have in the Southeast a non-attainment problem. There are a number of counties in the Southeast, in the Southeast that are non-attainment for either PM2.5 and or ozone. We already know from EPA that new designations are coming for the 1997 ozone standard, and we expect EPA to go ahead and propose and promulgate a more stringent ozone standard, probably in the neighborhood of 2014 or somewhere in that time frame. And that standard will probably be 70 parts per billion or less. And that's something we're already facing, and the reason that we're particularly concerned about freight is that we are expecting a growth in freight volume, including and most of that increase in freight volume will still be carried by trucks. In fact, the American Trucking Association suggests that the percentage of freight carried by trucks will probably go up a little bit. That's a national estimate, but the studies that we've seen estimate that growth in freight volume will go up over 2% a year. And then, as I said earlier, in addition, the distribution, the national distribution of freight volume is likely to go up in the Southeast region because of the Panama Canal expansion and the economic opportunities that will provide to people shipping goods across the country. We're concentrating on that legacy fleet, that so-called legacy fleet of 20 million diesel engines. That's the latest estimate from EPA after implementing the MOVES emission model. Of all those diesel engines that are out there on the road now, and the fact that there's relatively little regulatory authority available to EPA or the states to reduce emissions from those existing engines. A number of companies are delaying truck replacement in part due to the costs, the additional cost of the emission reduction technology that new engines have. And as a result, the fleet turnover to cleaner engines will take years. And Rebecca?
Yes, thank you, Alan. I'm going to provide a quick overview to why we're concerned about diesel emissions from a public health perspective. I imagine some of this information is familiar to a number of folks on the call, so I'll go through it rather quickly so as Alan indicated, we can move to the solutions piece. Diesel emissions are a big contributor to fine particulate pollution. They're also a significant source of air toxics, and this little diagram here shows you why that is and how the very small particulate matter that's in diesel exhaust can carry toxic compounds very deep into the body. And as a result, this analysis described at the bottom of the slide, which is based on EPA's National Air Toxics Assessment, concludes that diesel exhaust actually poses a cancer risk 3 times higher than all of the air toxics tracked by EPA combined. So it is a significant risk, both because of the particulates and also because of the toxics attached to the particles and in the exhaust. This slide shows you, if you're not familiar with what PM2.5 refers to, which is fine particulate matter regulated by EPA. This shows you just how small those particles are in the human hair diagram there on the right. So the small orange form there within the human hair shows you how PM2.5 would compare to a cross-section of a human hair. And then there's even a smaller category of particulate matter that is getting more and more attention from air quality scientists and epidemiologists, and that's called ultrafine particulate matter. It's not yet regulated, but diesel exhaust is a very significant source of ultrafines, and some epidemiologists are concerned that that may turn out to be even more significant a health threat than fine PM. These are some of the health risks that have been associated with diesel exhaust through scientific research. Probably the most robust sets of data are for respiratory disease and for heart disease. And again, it's the very small size of the particles that result in diesel particulate matter being a heart issue as well as a respiratory issue, because they are so small that they can actually enter the bloodstream. In recent years, some additional health risks have been emerging. Some of them, one recent study in New York City looked at PAH, or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are part of diesel exhaust, and found connections with reduced IQ associated with exposure in utero. So these are some of the other issues associated with diesel exhaust. You may also have heard or read about a couple weeks ago two significant studies just released on the lung cancer effects of exposure to diesel exhaust in minors. So that is a very quick high-level overview. And we're concerned about this both in terms of its contribution to non-attainment and also specifically with respect to exposures, and those are not evenly distributed. And we can think about the question of who is affected by diesel exhaust in two different ways. One, with respect to who is most sensitive. And we know that children and senior citizens and people living with respiratory, cardiac, and some other underlying heart problems are more vulnerable to the effects of diesel exhaust than others. And then number two, obviously, if your exposures are higher, the risk is more significant. And so people who live and work in occupations where they're exposed on a daily basis, or if they just live and work in areas with high concentrations of diesel exhaust, they're going to be at greater risk. And this is a map of truck volume in the United States, and you can see from these veins going through the country that truck volume
is
not
one of our maps, and it's not cited.
Of course, the same is true for rail. So exposures as a result also won't be evenly distributed. This map shows.
Double check. It might have been cited and just got cut off in the webinar.
With diesel exhaust, and you can see there is some similarity between the two maps. The areas where we see the highest levels of risk from diesel soot are pretty similar to the areas where we see the highest volume of goods movement. So where are these so-called hotspots located? Where are we moving goods throughout the country, and where are some of the local exposures going to tend to be highest? Ports and distribution centers, of course, where the freight is coming into the country. Freight corridors, and this map shows you some of the most significant freight corridors throughout the Southeast.
The entire interstate system.
One aspect of freight corridors that a lot of folks may not realize is that going through urban areas in particular, busy truck corridors are not limited to industrial areas. Because of limited planning in urban areas in the past, and to some extent this still happens now, where there just aren't a lot of choices, for example, for a school system as to where they may put a new school. freight corridors may pass very close to areas, densely populated areas where people live, where schools are located. And I give one example here. There was a study several years ago nationwide that found about a third of U.S. public schools are located very close to major roadways. So a lot of opportunities for exposure to that sensitive population of children. Other areas in urban centers where there may be disproportionate exposures include distribution centers and rail yards. This is a quick summary of some of the research that we use to inform our discussion of how close is too close. So what does close to a busy roadway mean? There was a comprehensive survey of all the research by the Health Effects Institute, and they came up with a fairly conservative estimate that if buildings can be located further than 500 meters than to a busy roadway, that is the best way to ensure that there are not going to be exposures. The least conservative estimate of what area would be considered a danger zone is about 150 meters from a busy roadway. The CPAC here that's referenced on the slide, that's a Children's Health Policy Advisory Committee of the EPA, and their recommendation to EPA with respect to school siting was to actually screen as far as a half mile from a busy roadway or a freight route. California is the only state that has actually implemented policy to try and prevent proximity between schools and freight corridors, and they now have a law prohibiting new schools from being built less than 500 feet from busy roadways because of the risk. And Alan, I'm going to pass it back over to you.
Okay, thanks very much. In looking at this issue, this connection, this intersection between freight planning and air quality, I guess one of our most significant goals is to enlist the transportation community as allies in making air quality improvement a major goal of all freight planning efforts. And we believe that transportation agencies' goal, and I think this is true, most transportation agencies in doing freight planning, one of their goals is to reduce congestion. We believe that's very complementary and consistent with the Southeast Diesel Collaborative's goal of reducing diesel emissions. In other words, if you're successful in reducing congestion related to freight, you're also going to be successful in reducing the emissions associated with particularly those trucks. We hope that in the future that freight planning efforts can identify opportunities for air quality improvements. What are the strategies that might yield air quality improvements? And to emphasize those strategies, particularly those strategies that address freight bottlenecks and heavily traveled transportation corridors, and to elevate the funding priority of those projects that address bottlenecks, in part because some of the solutions for addressing bottlenecks are particularly expensive. There have been at least a couple of studies in the recent past that have identified freight bottlenecks nationally, and oftentimes those bottlenecks occur at interstate interchanges where two interstates intersect in urban areas, and as most of you know, that right-of-way, the cost of that project to add capacity, for example, at that bottleneck, the right-of-way costs, the real estate costs are just astronomical. We want to try to stay ahead of capacity to reduce bottlenecks, encouraging the mode shift, and one of the issues that the rail industry has raised is the fact that rail companies are in many areas of the country nearing that capacity and adding additional loads, additional cars, additional trains to that infrastructure is almost out of the question, at least in some parts of the country, and that to improve that infrastructure is going to be very expensive indeed. In fact, the rail industry argues that they won't be able to afford it on their own. The example in the slide, investing $49 million in Miami-Dade County in freight rail restoration. Of course, the big benefits of, in this case, the estimate of avoiding 34 million gallons of fuel over the next 20 years. And of course, that's based on modal shift from trucks to trains. Green corridors is one of the priorities of the Southeast Diesel Collaborative, a regional priority, and the idea is to help establish green infrastructure along interstate corridors to reduce the environmental impacts of use of that corridor. For example, to establish biofuel infrastructure to increase the availability of biofuels, the fuel most relevant to trucks would, of course, be using B20 biodiesel blends, which most heavy truck engines can use without modification. Provide incentives is another policy option. Provide incentives for truck stop electrification and auxiliary power units to reduce extended idling. We need to see more truck stops outfitted with truck stop electrification technology to give truck drivers that option of turning their engine off while they're getting their required hours of rest. But there aren't enough truck stops in the country to solve the problem. There's a acute truck parking shortage across the country. In Tennessee, you can visit any rest area early in the morning and see what I'm talking about. You'll barely be able to get in and out of that rest area because of the trucks parked on the entrance and exit ramps. So we need the auxiliary power units, the onboard small onboard generators, if you will, to give truckers
the third option, not
now relevant to trucks, but another characteristic of green corridors would be electric vehicle charging infrastructure. And some people have argued that what federal agencies really need to consider, and this is federal highways, EPA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, DOE, if they could target funding to help accomplish some of these goals in critical corridors, in other words, really focus on a few corridors and see what make those corridors greener, and then move on to another set of priority corridors. And I think this one's yours, Rebecca.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. At a more local level, one of the things our committee's been trying to encourage is to have the regional freight plans, and we commented specifically on the one in the Atlanta metropolitan planning area, take into account exposures, not just overall emissions reductions, when they're looking at what is the best way to move freight through an urban area. So listed on the slide are some of the things that we commented on with respect to that particular freight plan: distance from roadways, location of schools, senior centers, other areas that might have particularly sensitive populations, and both pedestrian and commuter traffic. A lot of people don't recognize that when cars are sharing roadways with diesel trucks, they actually pull the diesel exhaust into their cars while they're commuting to work.
That's why I do internal circulation.
So communities with a high proportion of young children or seniors or both can receive special attention in freight route planning, and other options investigated if an area has a high concentration of those types of facilities. And this is an example from Miami-Dade County. They didn't actually do this for freight planning, but they looked at concentrations of seniors in making decisions about which waste haulers would be retrofitted. So they recognized that seniors are a vulnerable population, and they used this GIS overlay to look at areas with the most seniors and prioritize the cleaner waste haulers. And they're suggesting with this diagram here in the slide that they could take a similar approach to to try and look at whether some of the freight routes could be shifted to avoid senior intensive areas. Mitigation is also a possibility, and I'll just do this very quickly because I know we're about out of time. In areas where houses are not going to move or a school's not going to move, and it's clear that the freight route is the only option in that area, there is scientific evidence that different types of barriers may be helpful. And so air intake filtration systems, vegetative barriers may be explored in situations where the proximity just cannot be changed. And Alan's going to wrap up with an overview of solutions we at SCDC believe should be explored.
Thanks, Rebecca. The several opportunities, we call them, where and we think that each of these needs more discussion and more examination to see which ones might be most effective. But we wanted to survey the transportation agencies to identify existing studies that identify trucking patterns and needs. The previous presentation is a good example. We want to identify where truck parking facilities might be most needed, the strategic locations for those facilities, and see if we can work together as a region to seek funding. We think that might be a more competitive approach. Comprehensive recommendations to include in MPO and state freight mobility plans, recommendations that speak to air quality and how freight planning may contribute to air quality improvement goals. We would like to see how this might be done, how to improve coordination between and the integration of MPO, state, and regional planning. In fact, I think we would argue that more regional planning, for example, a region like the Southeast or the Northeast, how that region functions as a unit, because freight, of course, tends to ignore political boundaries, and freight movement issues tend to be those of the region. For example, the I-81, I-40 corridor, where the state of Virginia has done a lot of work. We'd like to see continued federal funding to speed up emission reductions through retrofit projects. Retrofit technology is still one of the most cost-effective ways to reduce diesel emissions. And we also would like to see more partnerships with communities that are disproportionately affected to address their local concerns. One idea that was mentioned was to develop virtual freight networks as part of ITS and transportation system management and operations. The establishment of software applications to provide load matching for shippers and truckers to alleviate center facilities, to support more rail intermodal use and economic development. Zoning laws and incentives can help with that. There are also innovative strategies that we could explore. Off-peak delivery schemes. For example, Dell in Nashville, their distribution facility, they've scheduled all their freight shipping and receiving operations at night, and it's been good for the company, and it's helped help Nashville with congestion and that truck traffic. Another example are ship-to-rail projects that eliminate the need for drayage truck operations directly between those two modes. And the need to try to really focus on those opportunities for mode transfer. Where is it possible to transfer or to divert more truck freight to more efficient rail and barge transport? And maybe this is the key thing. Where are those opportunities for increasing mode transfer, where the government's role might be to address strategic obstacles to, for example, for better connections between rail, truck, and barge traffic, where that government program or that government incentive or assistance might really make freight transfer from trucks to other modes make that more possible. We really do appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, and we'll be glad to answer questions a little bit later during the question and answer period. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Alan and Rebecca. We're going to move on to our final presentation, and then we'll go back for questions after this last presentation. Our next presentation will be given by Alan Bates of Shore Power Technologies. So, Alan, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you to Jamie and to Alan and Rebecca. I think, you know, this sort of works out well, because I think Jamie's speaking about the truck, the energy intensity, the amount of energy it takes to run these trucks, and then Alan and Rebecca speaking about sort of the problems that we face just as people around these diesel emissions. We have a solution for that. And Shore Power's been around since 2004.
From the Georgia division.
I'm the Vice President of Marketing, as Jennifer mentioned, and this project that we have, we make boxes that trucks can now plug into to basically shut their main engine down and allow them to run off of the grid. And it's a it's an important thing, because we have really a threefold problem. We have an environmental problem, which is 2 billion gallons of fuel
that,
basically
think.
Wasted every year through this idling unnecessarily during rest periods. This creates a big compliance issue. You have a number of states now that have laws on the books that prevent idling, and they're now starting to enforce those. And then you have the cost of the fuel itself. In an industry where the margins are very thin, every trucking company, every owner-operator is looking for ways to trim their costs, and fuel is one of those big categories that they can trim. The Shore Power project that we have is a DOE-funded program that's designed to put both equipment in the ground to allow trucks to plug into and equipment on the trucks. We're effectively trying to replace petroleum with electricity. Very simple concept. It's an alternative to idling. So where most truck stops never had this really ability to give to trucks, we're now providing that. We're putting this in. We're creating a new normal. We're trying to transform the truck transportation industry. And this is, again, one of those things that we can do to help curb those emissions. We're building 50 truck stops. We're building equipment at 50 truck stops nationwide in about 28 to 29 states. On the average, we'll have 24 connections to start. We'll expand as the service starts to take off. And we've already pre-selected these locations. Now, at this point, we're building those now. And that's based on a number of factors, including where the freight is moving, the proximity to other sites, a number of factors that we look at. We're seeding the market with incentives. So we have a partner in Cascade Sierra Solutions, which is providing rebates and incentives to drivers that can and fleets to put equipment on their trucks, and there's a number of pieces of equipment that can plug in. We're going to share that data, all the information we collect, with the Department of Energy in a big report. And we're currently now, as we build this infrastructure, we're signing up green first mover fleets. So you have a variety of fleets that have started to move. We are supported by the Energy and Transportation Air Quality Agencies. Obviously, this is a topic that's near and dear to hearts of probably many of you. We're basically very simple. Yeah. We currently have about 29 states. Again, the last I checked on the ATRI website, in 48 jurisdictions. The green that you see on the map here is only going to get greener. I don't believe any states are going to go backwards and say, you know what, those idling laws, we're going to take those off the books now. I think they're only going to get more in number and in enforcement. So we're simply providing a way for drivers now to make a decision, or a fleet to make a decision, do something other than idling. This is the current map of sites that we have. So you can see there are a number of current locations that we have in operation, and there are not quite a few future locations. And I'm happy to share the specific locations with you. These are, again, looking at I-5 on the West Coast, I-95 on the East Coast. We have I-10, I-20, I-80, I-90, and some feeder highways and interstates. And these are all sites, again, that were based on a number of criteria that we selected. And these will be the first rollout. We're hoping to eventually build 500 to 1,000 locations with some form of plug-in technology. This is, again, the first rollout, which represents about 65 locations. The TSD system that we have is simply it's a power pedestal that, like a marina or RV park, which you've seen for years, sits there, does its job year after year. It's fairly low cost to install, fairly low cost to maintain, doesn't have a whole lot of moving parts, provides a safety light. The secret sauce inside really is simply a remote payment control and activation system. So this is the vending part. This is the energy vending that we have. And it provides comfort and entertainment. So they're able to get power, which can power anything inside of their cab, electric, HVAC, whatever. And then also cable TV and wireless internet where it's available, some location. We're improving the air and noise quality. We're allowing drivers to comply with those laws, and the host site is actually able to make revenues on this as well. And the bottom line really here is what drives this whole thing is the fuel cost per night.
And
plugging
short
hours, dollar per hour, to idle a diesel on a main engine is our unit, which is a small diesel engine. It's a great, you know, solution in terms of reducing fuel consumption, but there's still higher cost involved with running that on diesel. Plus, when you add in the maintenance, you're still seeing an advantage to plugging in rather than burning on an internal combustion engine. To pay for the service, we allow drivers to go to an on-site kiosk, to call a toll-free number, or to use a web browser. It could be on a laptop or a smartphone. We also have prepaid cards, which are just simply gift cards that have stored value on them that they can use. We're also going to be moving into fleet cards, so fleet drivers that have certain programs that they're involved in that the fleet pays for, we will be accepting those in the future. The trends in terms of electrification in this market is, you know, obviously all fleet companies are looking to retain drivers. They're facing shortages. Their fleets are starting to green. They're starting to have sustainability objectives. There are a number of health issues, as Rebecca mentioned. You know, there's more mobile devices than ever, so everything needs to be plugged in. You've got laptops, you've got smartphones, you got TVs, you got all these things inside the cab that drivers are using. And to be able to actually use those for a 10-hour rest period, you need to eventually plug them in. A lot of companies are also electrifying their own terminals, so they're seeing the advantages of having at a warehouse or a loading dock or a depot places where these trucks can plug in. In some cases, you know, simply to heat or cool the cab, while drivers are waiting, or in some cases for transport refrigeration units, which I'll talk about as well. We are putting in about 30 locations where we'll have higher power 460 volt plug-ins for, again, hybrid refrigerated trailers. We believe that this solution we have really is the one of the long-term solutions to this problem of idling, because we're able to eliminate that petroleum consumption while they're resting. We're not producing local emissions. We're improving the noise quality in the area. The technology has been around for years, and it's proven in terms of the marina and RV industry. Again, we're simply reapplying that. Drivers can plug in anything they want, anything that they want. They have a lot of freedom to do this, and we're focused really on that specific idle reduction. It's of all the different types of things out there. Again, the high energy intensity it takes to run a truck, basically an apartment on wheels, we think, and actually we have proven that this is really the most efficient and most cost-effective solution as a simple onboard, what they call onboard TSE solution, truck stop electrification. We provide, again, that electric TRU standby power for pulling down a trailer to get it to a temperature to refrigerate goods. We're not recycling air. You know, every truck is now, all the OEMs have started to offer this as an option. And this is the most sustainable business model. As I mentioned, the trucking industry is starting to gear up. Today, all trucks can plug in with simply an extension cord and an appliance. Now, there are levels of convenience, and so that's where you come in, that the 20 to 30% of trucks now have some type of pre-wired convenience. Based on a lot of industry data and what we're seeing with the uptake of electrification, we know that, many trucks will now come with a shore power option, or it will be added shortly after purchase. The retrofit cost is anywhere from $100 on the low end up to a couple $1,000s if you're going more of a high-end, fully integrated solution. And the industry, again, our partner Cascade Sierra, as funded by DOE, is providing incentives to to upgrade a truck or an older truck. In terms of electrification, there are many companies, especially these first movers, early adopters, that are starting to electrify. And, you know, in fact, a lot of the large retailers, big box, are actually requiring that their shippers now meet some sort of green supply chain requirement. There are reliable technologies. There are at least 25 different pieces of equipment that you can put on a truck that can plug in to maintain cab comfort, or what we call hotel loads. And, you know, again, all of these trucks becoming more like RVs, they're requiring even higher power now, and we're able to provide that with 110 and 208 and now 460 volt power. There's obviously a big maintenance cost involved with any internal combustion engine. Fleets are fighting that. There's health risks by drivers. We're now recognizing what's going on, you know, in a truck stop environment or even around a truck stop environment. And people are seeing that, and they're, you know, having to react to that. And we're now seeing, obviously, as I mentioned, the idle reduction laws or anti-idling laws proliferating. These are some of the auxiliary power units that have plug-in capability. So you can see that there are a number of companies that are selling equipment that plugs in. And again, this is just an alternative.
Yeah, you can run
a small diesel engine on diesel, plug it in. This is a picture of, again, one of the ETRU or electrified transport project that's underway. A little more information on our website at short.org. That's plug into savings, all one word, .org. That actually talks specifically about, it's got a blog, there's a lot of information there. You can learn about this project. Again, a DOE-funded project in partnership with Cascade Sierra. We're very pleased.
All right.